Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. As you know, every once in a while, we've got to stop and go through all the legal cases that are in the news and try to break them down a little bit. And that's what we're going to do this week. And we're very fortunate to have with us Kimberly Atkins-Store, who is a senior opinion writer and columnist at the Boston Globe, is an on-air political analyst for MSNBC, and most importantly, perhaps for all of you out there, because we love the Sisters-in-Law podcast, she is one of those folks at the Sisters-in-Law podcast. Hi, how are you doing, Kim?
I am great, David. Good to join you.
Thank you very, very much. I've gotten sort of into a rhythm of doing this because it's every week, but all the cases move forward every week and something new, confusing happens in them. And I know you've been tracking them, but let's start with the one that really gets me crazy the most. And that's the Eileen Cannon stolen documents case. The reason it gets under my skin is that I'm a national security nerd, and I think that when you steal nuclear secrets, that's bad. I've seen people, they discover you steal the secret, they grab you, they put you in jail, and you're there for a while, because this is really serious stuff, except in this particular case. And it has seemed, for months now, that not only is Eileen Cannon inexperienced and so inexperienced that she doesn't actually understand the issues, but she's also deeply biased. And people keep telling me, well, don't worry, at a certain point, Jack Smith, that canny, clever guy, is going to pull the trigger. And he's going to go to the 11th Circuit and he's going to say, look, she's biased. She's inexperienced. And we need a new judge. But he hasn't done it. And now she's issued this really weird request of both sides to evaluate a set of instructions to the jury, or two sets of alternative sets of instructions to the jury, which are based either on stunning ignorance or stunning bias. It could be both. What do you think?
Oh, my goodness. I think that this case is a mess for a lot of reasons, including the one you highlighted at the top, is its importance. I think that it is somehow in some way weighted lower in importance with respect to all of the Trump actions. And it shouldn't be, because we are talking about national security. And I think that's an issue that should get even more attention given now that the former president, the presumptive GOP presidential nominee, is now $500 million in the hole from the New York judgment. And I think that in itself makes him a national security risk. So knowing that he had these classified sensitive documents, some of them very sensitive regarding nuclear secrets, as you pointed out, the fact that we don't know if they've all been returned, I think that makes this case especially important. So, yes, yeah, so this weird jury instruction order that you talked about from Judge Eileen Cannon. And look, I was willing to give her the benefit of the doubt in the beginning. In the very beginning, there was a lot of red flags waved at the fact that she is relatively inexperienced to be handling such a high profile case. But I am very much anti-judge shopping, and every judge on the bench was new at some point. And you ideally in the world, you get the judge that you get. You're not allowed to pick your judge. If it's an inexperienced one, well, that's how they get experienced, right? So I was wary to hold that against her. But as you said, she's doing some really inexplicable things, like asking both sides to weigh in on jury instructions, some of which embrace the completely nonsensical theory by Donald Trump that somehow the Presidential Records Act gives him cover from the charges that he faces under the Espionage Act, a different act that makes it illegal for you to have or mishandle classified documents, period. The Presidential Records Act has to do with like his notes or newspaper clippings that he might have gathered during the process of his presidency, those of which he also, under law, should have turned over, but turned over to the National Archives, right? The Espionage Act has nothing to do with that. That has to do with classified documents. So, either she doesn't understand that these are two different laws and that the charges that he faces have no defense under the Presidential Records Act, or yes, she's trying to muddy the waters for some reason. I think either would be grounds to seek her recusal in this case. So I, too, am not sure why Jack Smith hasn't done that.
Well, you know, I don't know how exposed you are, but I expect you are, actually, through your podcasting and your columns and so forth. But there is a corner of the internet that is a constant dogfight between the rabid Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice can do no right crowd and the rabid Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice can do no wrong crowd.
Yeah,
and these people hate each other with a passion that, you know, usually leads to wars in the world. But in this particular, no, it's like and I've gotten on the wrong side of both groups, you know.
Yeah.
And if you dare say that, you know, Garland could have moved quicker, they immediately respond by saying you're an idiot.
Yes.
Garland is, you know, you don't know what he's thinking. And then on the other side, if you dare say that, Garland is being extra cautious, people go, he's the reason the republic will fall.
Yeah.
But here's one that mystifies me, and it goes to your point about judge shopping. There were four judges in the Fort Pierce, Florida zip code. You know, there were like four that it could have gone to, mm-hmm. one of which was, you know, Eileen Cannon. And for some reason, Jack Smith said, yeah, hey, let's do it down there. Even though the odds were not in his favor,
yeah.
As they say in Hunger Games. And, you know, it turned out exactly in the worst case possible. Can't we, even at the risk of inflaming the DOJ can do no wrong crowd, can't we say this was a mistake?
See, I don't know. I even if, let's say the worst case scenario is true in that Judge Cannon is biased and not just bad, okay? The solution for that to me would be to seek her recusal. Now, I get it I worry not so much about the two camps that you described, but about public opinion and average Americans trying to understand what's going on. And I do worry that at this point, trying to seek her recusal would look like sour grapes after Georgia, what happened down there, even though they're two completely different scenarios, right? They're going after Cannon because, Trump and his defendants went after Fani Willis. I worry. I think that's a genuine worry. It muddies the water. He should have done this a while ago. But I understand Jack Smith saying, look, this is a rock solid case. He took these documents. He was asked for them back. He refused to give them. He obstructed. He ordered people to hide them. They were in the bathtub. Like, it's what a clear cut case. What better way to try this than right in his backyard, right in the state of Florida, to show that it's not just DC coming after him. We're doing this by the book. This occurred in Florida. We'll go after him in Florida. I think that was the right thing to do. And just because she's biased doesn't mean that the original sin was Jack Smith's. I think the original sin was hers.
Well, that's extremely charitable, and I now know which camp you're in, and I'm going to have
to. I am not in either camp. Listen, somebody from DOJ yelled at me this very day, so I assure you am not in that camp.
I'm just kidding. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, this interpretation that she's floating out there is, as I understand it, a possibility that she says, well, no, I'm just getting your reactions. I'm trying to prepare for the trial. And
I'm just floating balloons here.
Right.
That's not what judges do.
No, no, it's true, but she's doing it, right?
Yeah.
And so then she, you know, it's just like, you know, the way she's handled some of the other things is she hasn't made a decision that could get her kicked off the case. She's only made decisions that can delay the case.
Yeah.
And she's floating these things out there. But at a certain point, the case actually begins. And at that point, she has the power to make decisions based on completely insane theories that could unappealably throw out the case.
Yes. And that's why I contend. I the only thing I disagree with what you just said is that it is not yet. She hasn't done anything that is recusable yet. I think because if she delays any further and a jury is impaneled, then whatever decision she makes, whether it's the decision she hasn't made yet that she should make first before this jury selection nonsense, which is whether to throw out or dismiss some of the charges against Donald Trump or to direct a verdict. If she waits to do that after the jury's impaneled, then double jeopardy attaches and Jack Smith won't be able to appeal that, which is a problem. And I think that exigency in itself is enough for Jack Smith to go and at least try to get her set aside from this case. Now that in it's setting her aside would also cause a delay, right? There's no great solution out of any of this. But the longer that they wait to do that, the more damage is done. And if he does it later, then it won't matter anyway.
But you know, you bring up a really interesting point about the court of public opinion. Not these smaller groups, but the court of public opinion. And I think there's a phenomenon taking place, which we've never seen before, because nobody's ever seen this before, which is the conflation of all these cases into one mega case in the minds of people. That there's one set of issues, and that the Trump team is actually playing this way. You know, they're saying, well, you know, the immunity comes up in every case, or, you know, judge bias comes up in every case. They make very similar arguments. And so in the minds of the public, if Fannie Willis has a problem, all the judges have a problem. If the Supreme Court smiles on the immunity argument for a while, it all of a sudden makes it, I mean, there's a legal reason for that to some extent, but all of a sudden, it's another question mark over all the cases. It's an interesting approach, particularly if you view the cases not as legal cases, but as the primary vehicle for the Trump campaign.
Yes. Well, in a way, they add fuel to the Trump campaign in that his campaign is all about grievance, right? It's all about his own personal victimhood. And he's using that to substitute himself as the country, right? They're coming after me because they're really coming after you. That's the crux of his entire campaign pitch. So to the extent that he is facing charges, he just rolls that up into, it's all political. It's a part of an attack on him. He also frequently uses the "I know you are, but what am I" argument when it comes to anything, which is why I worry about the idea of, although the correct ruling came down in Georgia that whoever Fani Willis was dating, it did not amount to an actual or even apparent conflict of interest. There was just this odor of mendacity that required Wade to step aside, which that last part I think is ridiculous, but whatever. There was no conflict.
But nothing. I do think that eau de mendacity is the cologne that Donald Trump wears.
He's selling it on his campaign website. But because that happened, I do worry that to the average, I'm not talking about Trump supporters. I'm talking about the average American who does not follow these things as closely as you and I do, would think, oh, well, okay, so, you know, the Republicans went after Fani Willis, and now the Democrats are going after Eileen Cannon. And that does not advance the rule of law. I worry about that. I'm not saying that's a reason not to seek her recusal. I just worry that it needs to be done carefully and explained by folks like you and me so that the public understand what's going on.
Yeah, well, let's take that case for a second. I've been perplexed by that. Because I'm just a guy from New Jersey, you know, I don't really understand how all these things work. But it seems to me that if you're going to eliminate somebody because of a conflict of interest or try to, that you need to have a conflict of interest. And that we had a trial, which went on and on and on and on. And there was never any conflict of interest demonstrated, you know, and there was like, well, maybe she shouldn't have been dating this guy briefly during this period. But you know, that's not a conflict of interest. There's no conflict of interest in that. And yet it's not over yet, because now we are in a 10-day period in which they then have the right to go and appeal this, and they will appeal it. And then the appeal can take several months. Even just getting a decision not to hear the appeal could take a month. And it just keeps pushing this down the road. But the other thing it does is it fills the air with eau de mendacity. You know, it's like all of a sudden, every day, this trial comes out. And one of the things I've noticed, which is kind of weird, and I wonder if you've noticed it too, is that the TV commentators on the allegedly objective news panels, slowly but surely during the course of this trial, started buying into the, oh, well, Fani Willis did something wrong here. And I was like, but she didn't. And they're like, well, you know, it showed bad judgment. And it's like, holy mackerel, that's not an issue here. You know, they're going into things, they're bringing stuff in here, which is a political technique. It's not a legal technique. But what do you think?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I was gobsmacked in the beginning. There were some commentators who I had listened to and respected very much and thought were smart that were predicting she'd get kicked off the case. And I was thinking, what facts are you watching here? Because when it comes to conflict of interest, I will borrow a phrase from Barb McQuaid. It has to be on opposite sides of the V. You know, in a case, you have the people versus Donald Trump. The bias has to be between the people, the prosecutors, and Donald Trump, the conflict. In this case, the only thing that was alleged was on the same side of the V. It was between the prosecutor and the special prosecutor who she hired. So that was never on the table in my sense. Was it something that I wouldn't have done? Would I have dated the person who I picked? Let alone pick someone who I dated? No. But that's not the standard there. It's conflict. I do. One thing that frustrates me is I think at sometimes there is this idea of substituting your own judgment as opposed to applying the standard or expressing your uneasiness. And I think that's what we see a lot of these commentators doing. They express uneasiness at the fact that Fani Willis did it, and they worry that it'll hurt her case. So they want some kind of action, or they want to express that. To me, I see it very clearly. You have folks who are trying very hard to uphold the rule of law, right? And you have other people who are trying very hard to destroy the rule of law. And I'm not going to attack the person who upheld the rule of law and who's actually doing a really dogged job of trying to uphold the rule of law for, you know, quote unquote, bad judgment vis-a-vis someone trying to steal an election. Let's keep the eye on the prize and stop with the, you know, friendly fire that I'm seeing directed at Fani Willis. I also think it's easier for people to do that because she's a woman of color, but that's my own personal opinion on that.
Oh, but she got slammed for raising that issue.
Of course she did. But even in the ruling that found her that she had committed, as if she doesn't have a right to defend herself against what was essentially an assassination of her character. That was not an evidentiary hearing. That was an assassination of her character that was carried live on cable news. And of course she had the right to defend herself.
That's exactly right. She had every reason to be as pissed off as she was. But, you know, and she's also swimming against this stream that underlies both of these cases and all of these cases, which is that even in the mainstream media, or even in the part of, you know, the MSNBC media, the more progressive media, everybody feels that they have an obligation to bend over backwards. To do that, bending over backwards is a move that I'm going to call the Merrick Garland. And it's to do a Merrick Garland in favor of Trump. So let's bend over backwards and give Eileen Cannon the benefit of the doubt. Let's bend over backwards and give Judge McAfee the benefit. Everybody's like, oh, McAfee, he seems like he's doing this. This is the Fulton County judge. He's doing a pretty good job on this. He totally lost control of this process.
He did. He did. He did a terrible job. I will call it the Comey approach. Like, you're trying so hard to look like you're being fair that you're missing the plot.
That's good. Right? Comey is good. That's exactly where that happened. Although with Comey, at least we entertained the possibility that maybe that wasn't what he was doing. You know, that maybe he was putting his thumb on the scale a little bit. And in these cases, you know, it's a bit of a mess. Another place, of course, where we've seen this is the whole immunity argument with the Supreme Court, which the Supreme Court could have dispatched in 25 different ways much more quickly, but instead has decided to extend, not have a hearing until a month from now, probably not produce a decision until the end of June, even though the idea of president having immunity is ludicrous and was dispatched in a comprehensive titanium steel built decision by the DC circuit that, you know, you just can't find any argument that, you know, against it. They built it that way. But that we could be waiting until the end of June or into the beginning of July for the court to say, oh, no, he doesn't have that, which, of course, plays into his hands. You sighed. Are you as frustrated by this as me?
Oh, at least. I mean, I still can't fully explain the reason for the delay. And look, I know reasonable people can disagree as to whether this was the Supreme Court delaying it. Reasonable people, including my husband, for example, who called this an expedited review. He covers the Supreme Court. And I was like, what expedited is about? Expedited is Watergate. Like, expedited is the Pentagon Papers. Like, these are things that got to the Supreme Court within weeks.
Bush v. Gore.
Bush v. Gore was expedited.
3 days.
This was scheduled. Well, first of all, nothing happened for 2.5-3 weeks. And then finally, rather than just affirming the lower court, they scheduled arguments for literally the last day that an argument could possibly be held on the regular calendar. And it's probably going to be the last case decided this term. I mean, to me, that's a slow walk. And I hope the worst case scenario is that the court grants the second request of Donald Trump, which is to remand this case back down below, which just ensures it's pushed off into eternity at some possible future point, or not tried at all. I'm hoping that there is no chance that this court adopts this ridiculous view that the president has almost complete immunity and can order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his political opponents.
But there's a middle view, though. There's actually a middle case, which I worry about more. Mm. And that is that the court says, the president only has immunity on his official duties. And so the lower court must determine on point by point whether his actions pertain to his official duties. Have at it, lower court.
Oh, my God.
And because that was kind of the hand that some of the guys on the right were tipping in all of this kind of thing. And all of a sudden, Judge Chutkan is going to spend the next year making rulings that are then going to be appealed back up as we debate what right. is actually his official duties.
Right. That was sort of my worst case scenario in the beginning. You explained it a little more clearly. But there is also, when you said middle ground, what I thought you were going to say is that happens, but Trump wins the election, and so the entire case goes away.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's...
Well, so I mean, there's that. Yeah, I mean, we're assuming that she gets this chance if there continues to be Merrick Garland or someone of his ilk at the DOJ. But yeah, it's just really gobsmacking that the Supreme Court could not, even in a per curiam decision, just in a unanimously say, this absolute immunity stuff is garbage. Like, we don't even have to deal with this. But the fact that they couldn't, and that it took several weeks to even grant certiorari on it, tells me that there is some internal struggle happening on that bench, and I'm afraid of what it is.
Well, each one of these things is linked, in my mind, in that in the case of the canon, you know, the objections raised by Trump and this argument that somehow the Presidential Record Act let him take top secrets and turn them into his diary. In the Fannie Willis case, where there was no conflict of interest, and in this case where the president doesn't have immunity, each one of those cases are a situation where you would hope the judge would say, "You nuts! Next, you know, I mean, right? Because it's because yes. it's these are crazy.
Yes.
This stuff is groundless and indefensible."
Yes.
And yet that's actually working. Wait till they get to stuff that's complicated.
Yeah, no, that's a really important way to think about it. I mean, the conflating the Presidential Records Act with the Espionage Act would have gotten me a failing grade in law school, right? Like that's really inexplicable. Or, you know, some sort of absolute immunity claim too. Like I would have had to retake con law. Like that wouldn't have flown yet. It's actually being entertained by the highest court in the land with full arguments and a full, you know, giving the justices months to make a ruling. Even saying it out loud, I can't believe that that's actually happening, which is why it's very difficult for me to try to predict. You know, most people are like, well, there's no way they're going to rule that he has this. I don't know. Like, I have not predicted anything about any of this correctly so far. So I don't know what's going to happen. And it's frightening.
Right. I think that's right. And I think, you know, they're playing for time and they're getting it. The one place they're not successfully playing for time is in the New York civil fraud case, where they dropped a $500 million judgment on Trump. And he has responded saying, oh, but that's really unfair that I have to pay that. And nobody has said yet, well, actually, that's the law.
Yeah.
And it looks like he's not going to be able to raise it. And today, even like 60 seconds before I signed on to this, I saw something to the effect that Letitia James was starting the process of seizing the assets of the Seven Springs property in Westchester County. Mm-hmm. Because I think he have till Monday or something like this?
Monday.
This does not look like it's going to play out real well for him, does it?
No, it does not. I mean, I saw someone speculate that the state of New York may try to work out some sort of settlement with Donald. I was like, why? Like, what incentive do they possibly have to work out a settlement when they can just start attaching things? You know, first Donald Trump said, well, how about you take $1 million instead of half 100 million instead of half a billion. And I'm thinking, this is not let's make a deal. Like, what? No, the price is what it is. You either post cash or a bond. He can't. Well, he's having difficulty getting a bond. I wonder why.
But by the way, there's a second half of that, which is you either post that or you don't get to appeal.
Right. You cannot proceed with your appeal. Right. He wants to appeal, continue dragging this out without putting up. But yes, you have to literally put up or shut up in this case. So he wants to keep talking and not put up, and Letitia James isn't having it. So if it were me, if I had to put up a bond before I could proceed with anything, I couldn't just go to a judge and say, oh, well, yeah, but you know, I'm having a lot of difficulty. They would say, you know, tough luck. And I think that is what's going to happen to him, and the attachment proceedings will start swiftly, particularly against any property within the state of New York.
Well, and even so, you know, this will be embarrassing for him, but perhaps he will use it for fundraising. So the last question I've got for you, as our time nears its end, is we've got a trial that's supposed to have started. This next week, but it'll start in a month, coming up, that is called variously the hush money case. And everybody was like, well, you know, this is not a big deal case. And it's weak in some respects. And, you know, to me, it's not a small case. You know, I mean, the guy started out running for president by saying, I want to bury facts about me, because otherwise voters might not vote for me, and then I might not get to be president. And, you know, he seems to be, you know, have had some success in slowing it down a little bit. But that was due to a bunch of last minute documents requests that, again, Trump got away for it, with dilatory, tactics that they're using. But
Right. We've
also learned in the past 24 hours that, like, of the 120,000 pages of documents that were handed over, 200 pages were relevant to the case.
Right.
It's not the big deal that it was said it was. And so No. This may proceed. Meanwhile, of course, there's back buzz about, oh, well, Michael Cohen, there's some other problem with him as a witness and so forth. What do you think, since this is going to be the only trial we're going to get for a while, you know, that this one is going to be elevated by virtue of the fact that it's got center stage or not?
Yes. And I also agree with you that this is more important than initially thought. I feel like even when Alvin Bragg indicted this case, there was a collective kind of awe among the people who wanted Trump held accountable, because it's like, oh, this isn't the one we wanted first, you know, like this isn't. But I do think that it's finally being framed in the correct way, is that this also is an election interference case. The interference came in a different form, as you pointed out. It was Donald Trump seeking something of value politically to get a hand up on his opponent by trying to suppress negative evidence about him, negative information about him. So while, paying somebody hush money may just seem like a plot in a bad B movie to most people, when it's done in the context of an election, it is fraud. It is wrong. And that's why he's facing 34, you know, among the 34 counts between him and his cohorts of falsifying business records. These are felonies. I know people call it like low-level felony or add all these adjectives. It's a felony. It comes with up to 4 years in prison, which makes it a felony. But it was an effort to try. It was one of many things he did to try to steal an election. And that's important. And I hope that Alvin Bragg prosecutes it exactly in that way to make it clear. Yes, there are a lot of problems with it. You know, you can attack Michael Cohen's credibility because he too was a felon in this scheme. But you know what? He pleaded guilty and served his time for it. And, you know, he also has receipts. There's lots of evidence that shows that exactly what he's saying is exactly what happened. So I do hope people pay attention to it, have an open mind, and realize that it's probably more serious than a lot of people think it is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm older than you, so I can say periodically, I remember when. But I remember when, you know, Howard Dean didn't get to run for president because he made a funny noise on camera. Or, you know, Ed Muskie didn't get to run for president because he got a snowflake in his eye and it looked like he was crying.
Right.
Or you know, I mean, we can go through a long list of things. Any one of these cases that would in the past, you wouldn't have had to have the case.
Right. Could you imagine if a presidential candidate had been found liable for sexual assault and then continued to defame the survivor?
Any of them. They wouldn't have had to go to court. It would be like over.
Yeah.
And yet we've hit the point where due to the sort of saturation bombing of the Trump campaign of our laws and our values, we just accept it all. It's a stunning turn of events. The one good silver lining that I can take from it is that it requires us to periodically turn to you and get to have these conversations. And I will add, by the way, and this is not my role here, but I will add, I'm not Room Raider, but your room, the room that I see behind you, is the best one I've ever seen.
Thank you.
I mean, the color coordination, the fact that it's, you know, not traditional, it's a little bit more contemporary, you know.
Yeah, it's like mid-century modern.
Mid-century modern. It's really great.
Well, thank you.
And so, you know, you get an 11, not a 10. So.
I really appreciate that. You're very kind.
Well, thank you very much, Kim, and I hope we can talk to you again soon.
Anytime.
So that's it for this episode. We've got more coming, you know, many more, 3 a day sometimes, as we will tomorrow on Friday. Go to thedsrnetwork.com if you want more information. But if you listen to it all the way through and you thought it was good and you want to be a member and help support what we're doing, you go to thedsrnetwork.com, click on membership. It's a few bucks a month. It really helps us do this great stuff. And we'd be grateful. And you'll be grateful, I think, if you get to listen to the whole of each one of the 20-odd episodes of podcasts we put out each week. Until then, bye-bye.